In a world of Democrats,
there will be time for them to make profits. Now's not that time.
And Republicans,
I've abandoned free market principles to save the free market system.
You need a voice of liberty. Look no further. You found it. Tom Woods. Beware, citizen. You are now departing from the world of allowable opinion. The Tom Woods Show.
Welcome to the Tom Woods Show, episode 356. My apologies to you listeners out there for the gap over the past couple of days. When I got back from Alabama, I was keynoting the State Convention of Young Americans for Liberty in Alabama. I got sick late that night, late Sunday night, and I'm still, frankly, not fully recovered, but I've pretty much been laid up in bed for two solid days, and I just did not have the strength to do anything. So I apologize for no episodes, and of course I want to be a hero and somehow make those episodes up, but as long as I'm working on this Ron Paul homeschool program, there's just no way I have the time, unfortunately. But once that's done, probably in a couple months from now, if I really hustle, then in the future I'll be able to have a whole bunch of episodes in the queue so that if something like this happens to me, we can queue them up, so to speak, and they'll be ready to go even in my absence. But anyway, that's what happened. Sorry about that, but I just decided at some point you got to get out of bed and get back to doing things, so here I am. We will have the episode that I promised on the Keynesian multiplier, hoping that'll be tomorrow's episode, number 357. I had to reschedule three different people because of my illness, but that will be indeed coming up. But today, actually, I want to talk about something called the living wage. You can probably tell what that is just based from the name. The idea is that workers are entitled to be paid a wage that allows them and their families to live in reasonable comfort. Of course, everybody would like to see that outcome. There's no dispute about that. The question is, how do you bring it about? And you start to see some of this talk these days in connection with the $15 an hour campaign, whether it's with fast food employees or employees in other industries who are agitating for $15 an hour. So they're not just saying, let's increase the minimum wage, you know, by 20% or 30%. They're practically saying, let's double the minimum wage. So that's something beyond just a minimum wage increase. That's moving toward this concept of the living wage. And this has been a subject of controversy and advocacy for many, many years. I mean, certainly you can find it all through the entire corpus of Catholic social teaching. There's reference to the living wage. Now, it's much less specific about what exactly needs to be done to bring about that living wage, but it is very much present. So in both religious and secular thinking, you can find the concept of the living wage all over the place. And the reason it occurs to me now is that by happenstance, I happen to notice over the, you know, when you're sitting there in bed all day, you look at Facebook quite a bit. You don't have the strength, the mental strength to do anything else. So I was looking at Facebook, and there's a funny Facebook group called something like Robots for a $15 Minimum Wage. And of course, the idea is that if you encourage a $15 minimum wage, you're going to encourage a lot more automation. You're going to encourage robots. So the robots are saying, you know, think about our future. Let's have that $15 minimum wage so that the robots can get a fair chance. So the turns out the robots actually post some pretty interesting news items in that Facebook group. And so the whole thing just made me think about the living wage. So I thought I would spend some time talking about it. I actually wrote a whole essay debunking the idea of the living wage. You can read this essay for free. It's in a book, the entire text of which is online for free. And the book is called Catholic Social Teaching and the Market Economy, edited by Philip Booth and published by the Institute of Economic Affairs in London. Does not matter if you're not Catholic, by the way. I understand there are people who listen to my show who are not Catholic and some of whom are really angry about the fact that I am. But all right, that has nothing to do with this. You can still read this and get some good arguments out of it. So I'm going to link to that on the show notes page, tomwoods.com/356. I think it's a pretty well-developed argument in terms of it's got really all the key points you would need to make against the living wage. But there's always room for, you know, tweaks here and there. So I'll do some tweaks here as I talk to you. We all know what the standard arguments are against the minimum wage, and I'll link on tomwoods.com/356 to relevant episodes in which we've talked about this. We've had an episode on the fast food protest, for example. I'll link to that. Of course, one of them is if $15 an hour is a good wage, if wages, in other words, are things that are so arbitrary that we can just pass a law forcing them to some arbitrary level, then really any level we might force them to is arbitrary. Why $15? Why not $20? Why not $25? Why not $50? Why not $100 an hour? Why not $1 million an hour? Well, of course, naturally, the minimum wage proponent or living wage proponent will say, well, we know that if we require an employer to pay $1 million an hour, nobody will be employed. Aha. So they do understand that at some level, there is a disemployment effect of artificially high wages. They do understand that. So the issue just happens to be, where does that kick in? Well, we would say it kicks in above the market clearing level. But they seem to think, well, it kicks in above $15. Well, how do they know? Maybe it's $15.12. Maybe it's $14.88. What would make them think that $15 is some magic number? And of course, once they get $15, there's no reason to expect them to stay there. Then they'll agitate for $30 or $40. But of course, all the while, they are making the most vulnerable people in society less employable, less attractive to employ. And if you don't get that initial job that teaches you all these important job skills and human interaction and all this, then it's very hard to get to any other rung of the ladder. Very few people can leap over all the rungs. You need that first rung, and this takes that first rung away from you. Now, it's funny to notice, by the way, that unions are often agitating for a minimum wage, and that should stop and make you wonder, why are they doing that? Union members don't get minimum wage. That's why they're in a union, you know, to agitate for higher wages. Nobody in a union earns minimum wage. Why are they advocating for higher minimum wages? Think about that for a minute. Is it out of the goodness of their hearts? Is that what we think about when we think about union bosses? There's just their hearts are just bleeding with concern for the justice for justice to be done to everyone. Well, think of it this way. If you're in a labor union, you are a skilled worker. And if you are getting minimum wage, you are not a skilled worker. Now, suppose you are you're in a labor union, you earn, let's say, $30 an hour, and you can basically do the work of three unskilled people. And the three unskilled people right now are earning $7.50 an hour. So three unskilled people, $7.50 plus $7.50 plus $7.50, would earn $22.50 and you're earning $30 an hour. They can undercut you. But suppose now that you agitate for the minimum wage to be increased to $15 an hour. Now three of those workers are going to cost $45 and you still cost $30. So maybe, I mean, there is a slight teensy-weensy chance here that union advocacy of minimum wages and higher minimum wages is meant to disemploy unskilled workers and to give an artificial boost to unionized workers. I mean, I'm just wondering if that's a possibility. That's something to be borne in mind. Now, of course, when we talk about wage rates, we first have to understand how do wages rise in the first place? Because, of course, it's the contention of those of us who do not favor an artificially imposed living wage and artificially imposed minimum wages. It's our view that wage rates rise on their own. So we need to explain how that happens. How do real wages rise? That is, how does the inflation-adjusted wage rise? And some of you who have listened to me for a long time know my standard spiel on this, which I'm really more or less borrowing from George Reisman, who's been a guest on this program a couple of times. But it runs sort of like this. Just think in terms of this thought experiment. Imagine a world in which Martians have come to Earth and they've spirited away all the goods that we use to produce consumer goods. So all the capital goods, all the machinery, all the assembly line equipment, all the transportation equipment, all the communications equipment, everything that we use that goes into producing the items that you and I buy and that you and I need, these are all taken away from us. And from now on, we have to produce all the things that we want to buy with our bare hands alone. Well, think about that. Think of yourself right now. Say you work 40 hours a week. And now the Martians have taken everything. And let's suppose you continue to insist on working 40 hours a week. But 40 hours a week with your bare hands, as opposed to 40 hours a week with a forklift, a steam shovel, assembly line equipment, whatever, a word processor instead of the labor of scribes. I mean, just think of everything, all these things being gone. Obviously, 40 hours a week just with your bare hands, you're going to be able to produce the tiniest fraction of the output you used to be able to produce when you had a more advanced economy, you know, 3 seconds ago before the Martians came. Anyone can see that. Anyone can see that without those goods, there would be some products we couldn't even produce at all, much less in the quantities that we have now. We couldn't produce at all. We couldn't produce a plasma TV at all with our bare hands. That could not be done. And then all the other things that could be produced, like clothing and food and shelter and just basic things that you need, medical care, could be produced in vastly reduced quantities. Let's just put it that way. I mean, much, much, much less. Because everything's being done with your bare hands, you could produce vastly less. So if you keep on working 40 of your crummy bare hands hours, and all of us keep doing that, we are going to be so deprived, we'll hardly know what to do with ourselves. There aren't enough rich people to go just take the stuff from the rich people, you know, like the dumb guy solution to all this. Let's just go take stuff from the rich people. That'll solve the problem. Obviously, the problem is, where the heck are our machines? That's the problem. The problem isn't that there are some people who somehow manage to become somewhat wealthy under these conditions. If we were to go to the wealthy people and take all their greater than average consumption and redistribute it to everybody else in society, we would not even notice the difference. Everybody would have one extra 1/20th of a table leg, and that'd be the end of it. That would do nothing to solve the problem. I mean, that's just completely uncomprehending to think that that would be the solution to our problem. The solution is we need the machines back, because with the machines, we can produce. I mean, even if we worked 120-hour weeks with our bare hands, we still would be hopelessly impoverished compared to how we had been living just moments earlier. So we need to get those machines back, because with the machines, we can produce vastly more with much less effort, with much more leisure time. And because we produce vastly more, the greater abundance of goods pushes prices down through the force of competition. And therefore, the money we earn in our paychecks can stretch farther and we can buy more stuff. And that's how our standard of living increases, is that the abundance of goods increases, which puts downward pressure on prices, and now we can afford more stuff. That's what happens. Now, you may say, well, it doesn't seem to me like prices fall very much. Well, that's because we have a Federal Reserve System that keeps prices going up constantly. But if you could abstract from that, what we're really looking at is prices relative to wages. And if prices are rising more slowly than wages, that's still the same phenomenon. And of course, before we had the Fed, prices were consistently falling all throughout American history. And we do still see prices falling in electronics, for example, where prices are falling so fast that even the Fed can't, even all the Fed's interventions can't push them back up. So what this means then is that if we want to improve the standard of living of anyone, what we want to do is make conditions as favorable as possible for capital accumulation, for being able to buy and invest in machinery and equipment necessary to make the production process more physically productive, be able to produce more stuff. That's what we should want. So both workers and owners and capitalists have the same interests. They both want more investment in capital equipment. My father was a forklift operator in a food warehouse for 15 years. What would he have done without that forklift? I mean, there's no hope, no conceivable hope. All the protests in the world couldn't have earned him the money he earned if he had had to stack all those pallets with his bare hands. He would have been so ridiculously unproductive. And yet there still would have been social justice people thinking that if they hold just one more candlelight vigil, that ought to be able to raise my father's wages. You know, you can take all your candlelight vigils and stick them. Because what we need is capital investment. We need forklifts. Then he's got a remote chance of getting a reasonable wage. All right, so let's go on and talk about some other aspects of this. Because I was writing this essay in a book on Catholic social teaching, I made reference to Pope Pius XI, who in his encyclical Quadragesimo Anno, very, very famous encyclical from 1931, he talked about the living wage, and he said that changes must be introduced so as to assure to workers as soon as possible the payment of such a wage. Okay, great. I agree. But the question would be, what should those changes be? And of course, the changes should be lifting all restrictions on capital accumulation, lifting all taxation on business enterprise, lifting all regulation that artificially stifles innovation and the plowing back of profits into capital investment. All those things have got to be discontinued immediately. Now, I rather doubt that's what Pius XI had in mind, but if his general principle is to be taken seriously, and if our analysis here is correct, and surely it is, then surely those are the changes. Those are the changes that we need to be making. But when we talk about this as a moral question, we say it's a moral question for people to be paid a living wage. There are some tricky aspects of this. First thing would be, if there's a moral obligation to help the poor, why should that obligation fall exclusively on the employer of all people? Like, why wouldn't your neighbor be more obligated to care for you than your employer? Like, why would your employer, who's already helping you out by giving you a paycheck, why would it be up to him to then give you even more when he's the only person in society giving you anything in the first place? He's the only person improving your material standard of living. Why, of all people on earth, would this person be the one most morally responsible for improving your well-being still further? If you want to help the poor, go ahead and do it. Why do it in this circuitous way of, well, we'll force this guy to give the poor a little bit more? Well, I think I know why people favor that solution, because it doesn't cost them a dime. It's really easy to talk about how generous you are toward the poor when all you can do is propose that somebody else, some wealthy person, somebody who runs a business, ought to be paying the poor more. But it seems to me that if the poor person goes before two employers, one of them refuses to hire him, let's say that's firm A, and firm B hires him for $7 an hour, the social justice people will extend, they will unleash all their anger at firm B. But firm A is paying the guy zero. Why does firm A get off the hook? I never understood this. So again, why would it be the employer of all people? So this is a moral question that seems to be rarely considered. Or also, George Stigler, the economist, noted decades ago that if you just want to meet the nutritional standards of the U.S. government in the year 1943, least expensively, a man weighing 154 pounds could consume the following in a year and meet the minimum nutritional standards: 370 pounds of wheat flour, 57 cans of evaporated milk, 111 pounds of cabbage, 23 pounds of spinach, and 285 pounds of dried navy beans. Now, for a wage to be fair, would it have to allow only this for food? Or, because that's what you need to stay alive. Oh, but you need to live in reasonable comfort, says the living wage doctrine. All right, well, what kind of variety of food would be fair? How would we even begin to answer that question? Are movie rentals part of fair compensation? If so, how many movie rentals per month would be considered fair? How many cigarettes would be considered fair? I mean, you see the absurdity of all this. There's no non-arbitrary way to make decisions like this. Now, I've sometimes seen, in connection with all this, the argument that, well, you know what? It's actually going to help the economy if we boost these people's wages, because then they'll have more purchasing power. You know, so this is the Keynesian magic. They'll have more purchasing power now. They can go out and buy things, and that will help the economy. Now, let's set aside one of the responses to that argument. One of the responses to that argument would be, at the higher wage, a lot of these people won't be able to get jobs at all. And if they don't get jobs at all, their paycheck will be zero, and they won't have any purchasing power. I will be a sport, and I won't even raise that argument. The way I want to attack this one is this way. If it's good for the economy for unskilled labor to be given an arbitrary, coercively levied wage increase, would it also be good for the economy if employers quit shopping around for low prices for steel and just paid more for steel, so the steel manufacturers would have more money to spend on consumption? Wouldn't that be good for the economy? Now everybody in the steel industry has more money to spend. Maybe it'd be even better if they went out of their way to pay more for lumber than the going price. Then the lumber people would have more to spend. And then maybe it'd be still better if employers paid extra for lumber, steel, labor, and everything else they needed. So in other words, if it's good for the economy, so-called, for business firms to pay artificially high wages, why not demand that they pay artificially high prices for everything? Then the economy would be super. Well, I trust you see the problem. The firm becomes less and less profitable and less able to support employment the more it needs to pay for inputs. And the more it pays for some inputs, the less it has on hand to pay for others. And so extra money paid in wages over here means less spent on intermediate goods and thus lower wages for other workers over there. And the firm is less able to invest in capital equipment, which is what makes all of society wealthier, as we've just been saying. And while we're at it, let's say something, too, about the misplaced emphasis on consumption, as if that's all an economy is about. If all we did was consume, and no one saved and productively expended any resources, the entire structure of production would grind to a halt. Just to maintain the structure of production involves saving enough to support the existing capital structure, which is all the stages and production processes from raw materials down to the finished product that constitute the intermediate stages of production. And these are all left out of GDP, by the way. We had an episode on that. If I remember that, I'll link to that too. So in other words, if we were determined to stimulate consumption, we should be happy at the following outcome. Suppose we have a lucky person, lucky because the doubling of his wages at McDonald's didn't force him out of a job through layoffs, or through the suddenly hastened automation of his job, or didn't force him to do extra work on the job, or didn't take away his fringe benefits, etc. Suppose we have a really lucky person. This lucky person gets his minimum wage increase, and he takes some of his extra pay and buys 5 gallons of milk. Then the milk seller takes the money he earns from this sale and buys a new shirt. Then the shirt seller takes the money from selling the shirt and buys a few gallons of gas, and so on. This is all consumption. Nothing is saved or productively expended. Well, what does this mean? This means no wages are paid, since making payroll is not consumption. No business-related bills are paid. Again, that's not consumption. No intermediate goods are ordered by later stage production. Again, this is not consumption. And so on. So the result of all this spending would simply be that the inventories of consumer goods would dwindle, and the gross saving necessary to keep the production structure up and running not having occurred, the productive capacity of the economy would collapse. There's your utopia of consumption. So obviously the economy is more than just passing money from hand to hand in exchange for consumer goods. To say that consumption needs artificial stimulus is just a morally and economically arbitrary value judgment. Only the voluntary decisions of all market actors, based on their own preferences and coupled with a market price system, can give rise to a structure of production that balances our desires to consume with the enormously complex latticework of capital and stages of production that make our preferred level of consumption possible. So the living wage argument is simply wrong on all grounds. It's wrong that it stimulates the economy. It's wrong that wages can just be increased arbitrarily, that we can just wish them into existence. Ah, if only we lived in a world like that. We could just summon things we want into existence by a command, like pass a law to force reality to be the way we want it to be. It's just wrong on every single level. So I urge you to check out the resources at tomwoods.com/356 for further information on this. But while I'm on this topic, I want to mention to you a publishing event that I let go by without comment, and I probably owe it to myself to say a little something about it. I've actually had one of my books have an anniversary that was observed by the publisher. I have a book that actually won me a very, very big book prize years ago. The book is called The Church and the Market, and it came out in 2005, so it's 10 years later. And the publisher, which is an academic publisher, was looking back at the series my book belonged to. It was in a series called Studies in Ethics and Economics. And they wondered, were there any of these titles they wanted to revisit in a new, revised edition? And when they looked at the sales figures for my book, certainly by academic sales standards, it surprised them how big the sales were, and it vastly exceeded the sales of anybody else on that list. So they said, well, this is the book we want to reissue. So they approached me and said, would you like to do a 10th anniversary edition of your book? I said, yeah, sure, because this way I'll be able to stick it to all the critics I've had over the years with a new chapter so that I close any loophole where they might have pretended to misunderstand my thesis. Can't do that anymore. There's an extra chapter in there now. There's a 10th anniversary introduction in there now, some additional material. Much, much, much more attractive cover. I'm really, really happy with it. So I'm going to link to that on the show notes page also, the 10th anniversary edition of The Church and the Market. Now, I know it has the word church in the title, so I know there'll be some people who'll be driven away. And that's a shame because I think this is probably my best work ever. And it's a book that you don't have to be in the church or in a church or interested in the church at all to profit from. It really is a book on Austrian economics. I mean, I had traditional Catholics in mind when I wrote it, and I do make reference to some church documents, but basically what I think of The Church and the Market as being is that intermediate book that you should read between Economics in One Lesson by Henry Hazlitt, everybody's beginner book, and things like Rothbard's Man, Economy, and State or Mises' Human Action, because that's quite a leap. And if you read The Church and the Market, I think it helps you make that leap. I absolutely loved writing that book. I loved every minute of it. And I knew, you know, you write a book like this for an academic publisher, you're not going to make money. I did it because I wanted to do it, because I thought it would be a contribution, because I love the material, for a lot of reasons. And as a matter of fact, it is a contribution. I think it's the most important contribution I've made to anything. And you'll have to see why when you look at it. But to make a long story really short, the way a lot of free market Catholics have tried to deal with the question of papal or episcopal statements that seem to run contrary to the market economy from time to time is to selectively quote from these documents and say, oh, no, look, the Pope's a free marketeer. What are you talking about? And that's just dishonest. Like, we all know that's dishonest. They know it is. Their critics know it is. Everybody knows it is. That's not the way you deal with it. You have to deal with it more honestly. You got to take these documents at their face value and deal with them. And my point has been that it's one thing to say on matters of faith and morals, the church is your guide. But so if the church says, you know, the family is is the building block of society, and we want to see the family unit encouraged and built up and strengthened, well, this, you know, fine, it's perfectly an unobjectionable thing to say. But then to say, so the way to do that is to impose a living wage so that the head of the household can earn a lot of money for his family, well, that's a totally different kind of statement, isn't it? Because that kind of statement takes for granted a whole series of cause and effect relationships. It takes for granted, for one thing, that wage rates can just be wished into existence. But of course they can't, you know, as we've seen from the analysis here. You have to have capital accumulation. You need a greater amount of capital invested per person, per head, to see the standard of living increase. So it's one thing to say, this is a moral ideal we should strive for. It's entirely different to say, and here are the technical methods necessary to reach that goal. Nope, sorry, qualitatively different statement, and has nothing to do with ecclesiastical authority whatsoever. Any more than it would to say, you know, we should build churches that are befitting of the dignity of God. Okay, nothing wrong with saying that. But then to say, okay, now here are the methods to make a church stand up the longest. Well, again, that's a secular discipline that you would have to be an expert in architecture to know about. So I mean, everybody sees the distinction there between the two kinds of statements, but they pretend not to see it in economics. And boy, did I take some abuse when this book came out. Oh my goodness gracious, I would rather any day be attacked by leftists or neocons than by traditional Catholics. Oh my gosh, oh, were these nasty people. Especially some of these are former friends of mine. Oh my gosh, were these nasty people. So I have a fresh chapter in the 10th anniversary edition that takes on at least one of these people. So check it out, tomwoods.com/356. The book is called The Church and the Market. I think it is a helpful book between Economics in One Lesson and the great Austrian treatises. It prepares the ground for you by introducing you step by step to a lot of important topics. I mean, if you've ever wondered about praxeology, you don't really understand it, or geez, how are they getting so much from just the statement human beings act? I mean, how are they getting value scales and cost and marginal utility and and supply curves and demand curves. How are they getting that all from that? I actually show you step by step. I draw it out explicitly, step by step, right in the very first chapter. But then everything from prices and the just price. Is there a just price? Is the just price the market price? Price gouging, wage rates like we've been talking about here, money in banking, interest rates. Is interest allowable morally? I go into that whole debate, explain that. Central banking, the moral dimensions of that, the economic dimensions of that, fractional reserve banking, the business cycle, foreign aid, the welfare state, distributism, the point of view of Belloc and Chesterton. It's all in here, that and much, much more. I mean, it's everything I could stuff into one book, and I think you'll enjoy it because on the one hand, at times it has that scholarly detachment that we all crave, but on the other hand, it can switch into polemical mode at the drop of a hat. So, you know, you got to hold on to your seat while you're reading it. All right, so that's the episode for today. Tomorrow I'm hoping to do the episode on the Keynesian multiplier, so important to cover that topic. If you're not, haven't subscribed to the show yet, remember, I release a new episode every weekday, except when I'm deathly ill. And sometime in the future, I'll even be releasing episodes when I am deathly ill. So make sure and subscribe over at tomwoods.com. You'll see links for iTunes and Stitcher there. Spread the word about the show to your friends. Visit the show notes page, tomwoods.com/356. Oh, and one last thing for all you guys supporting the show, the supporting listeners, I noticed there was an error. For some reason, the link to get my new book, Real Descent, in Kindle form, which you are all entitled to, the hyperlink wasn't active or something, and you should have told me. I'd be very happy to fix it. We did fix it, I believe, so you can now go and claim your copy of the book. If you haven't been able to do so up to now, my apologies for that. I didn't even realize there was a problem. All fixed. All right, thanks for listening, everybody. We'll see you tomorrow.
The Tom Woods Show.